This is the Yes to Life show, and I'm your regular host, Robin Daly, bringing you more insights into the world of integrative medicine for cancer. Last week, I promised you I'd be speaking to cancer and exercise specialist Lizzie Davis. My apologies, but Lizzie had to reschedule our interview, so I hope to speak to her in a couple of weeks' time. Watch this space. Meanwhile, I'm really pleased to talk to one of the brilliant speakers at our upcoming annual conference in London on the 19th of November, which is entitled Charging Down the Wrong Path. That's a quote from world-class theoretical physicist Paul Davis, who will be contributing to the conference about his findings from a multi-million dollar National Cancer Institute funded multi-center investigation into the mechanisms of cancer. And it refers to the whole of mainstream cancer research. My guest today is Patricia Daly, no relation to myself, a nutritionist and a specialist in the ketogenic diet. The Ketogenic Kitchen, which she co-wrote with Dominique Hemp, is a bestseller reflecting the enormous interest there is in the diet. I'm speaking to Patricia over Skype at her home in Ireland. Hi Patricia, lovely to talk to you again. Thanks for coming on the show and to bring us up to date with the developments around the ketogenic diet.
Yeah, hi Robin. Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
So I last spoke to you on the show about the time we launched The Cancer Revolution, our book about integrative medicine for cancer, which you kindly contributed material to on the ketogenic diet. Together with Dominique Hemp, you produced your own book, an incredibly successful hands-on book for the ketogenic diet, which is called The Ketogenic Kitchen. Now, this success has not been without controversy, however. Why on earth would the cookbook cause anyone to get hot under the collar?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I knew it would cause controversy, and that is the nature of my work. And I think I do like to research things as well that aren't necessarily part of mainstream protocols, and I'm well known for that, not just because I am Swiss and I grew up a lot with complementary medicine and it is enshrined in the constitution over there. For me, that's always one of the first things I look at as well. So there's different elements why I got so interested in keto for managing cancer, but it did cause a lot more stir than we thought it would. And a lot of people say, oh, this is a great sign, you know, if you, as soon as you are causing trouble and you do get the interest of, you know, the likes of the Irish Cancer Society, then it means you're doing something right, which I totally agree with. But I'm not a person who is looking actively for, you know, controversy and, you know, being attacked and attacking. So I do like to, you know, work in a calm and a very, you know, as rational as possible manner. And it just got completely irrational. That's what I was the most gobsmacked by. I don't think any of the main critics have ever even opened the book. And we could, you know, it was almost like banging your head against the wall. We constantly said, we really do think the ketogenic diet has its biggest potential as an adjunct to conventional treatment. It is a complement. It's not an alternative. We don't consider it an alternative. Please do your conventional treatments and do discuss everything with your oncology team, with your medical team, and also make sure you get monitored. And, you know, it's not a cure for cancer. We kept hammering that in, but it just did not get through. So that's what really gobsmacked me most, because we kept providing evidence and we kept, you know, sending those people videos of, for instance, Dominic D'Agostino, doctor, an associate professor in University of South Florida, Adrian Scheck, who is a professor in Arizona, Professor Tom Seyfried. It's not that it's all, you know, total and utter nutcases just making up things. You know, it's very, very solid researchers that actually came from more the conventional side and just really blown away by the potential of the ketogenic diet. And that's, I guess, what really took us aback, Dominique and I, and what we just couldn't understand.
Mm-hmm. It's medicine has got to be one of the most conservative areas of work in the world. In one way, you would say it was a good thing because, of course, they're being extremely cautious. But it can make progress enormously difficult, can't it?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Okay, so the ketogenic diet is definitely one of the kind of major new kids on the block when it comes to the insatiable need for new ways to help the ever-increasing number of people with cancer. But, okay, I understand that we're still a long way from having anything really conclusive to say about what it's able to do, who it's able to help, but there's plenty of good indications, so I'd simply like to explore them. So can we start with the basics? Can you tell us as straightforwardly as you can what the ketogenic diet is and why people with cancer might be interested in it?
Yeah, sure. So the ketogenic diet has actually, it's not that new. Actually has been used for almost 100 years now with epileptic children that don't respond to medication, especially. So, or just generally in epilepsy, we have the randomized controlled trials that we are so looking for other applications of the ketogenic diet. So it has been used for a long time. And the way they came across or basically made up the design, the ketogenic diet, is that doctors realized that epileptic patients, they had a lot less seizures or sometimes no more seizures when they were, for instance, sick, having the flu or something like that, and weren't able to eat for a prolonged time. So they were fasting and they realized, hang on, they actually, their seizures reduce. What could that be? And, you know, they did then come across also the ketone bodies. They had been obviously researched already at the time. I think it was in the mid-1800s that they were discovered. And then early 1900s, they started, sort of around 1920, they started to use the ketogenic diet then, because they said we can't just fast those patients for the rest of their life. We have to give them some food. So how can we mimic fasting? And that's how they came up with a very low carbohydrate diet. It's moderate in protein, in some cases even low in protein, and it's high in fat to get the calories in. And one of the principal goals, or one of the principal appealing factors for, especially for cancer patients, is that blood glucose levels tend to reduce. And I say tend to because that's very individual, but in most people, when you do cut out carbs, and especially carbs that, you know, hit the bloodstream fairly quickly and increase the serum glucose, then when they stop doing that, the glucose tends to go down. And for cancer cells, that can be a bit of an issue because they very much rely on a process called glycolysis, and which means they split sugar. They split sugar in a very efficient manner. They have developed some very sophisticated measures to actually be able to do that. And when blood glucose is reduced and then glycolysis is reduced, it really actually puts a spanner in the works for them. So they can't proliferate as quickly. They can't, you know, their ability to metastasize can also reduce, because when they don't split glucose as much, then lactic acid, that is a byproduct of this glucose splitting, is reduced. And then that has implications for metastasizing. But it's not only, and I think that's what we really have to bear in mind, is it's not just about the sugar or the glucose in the blood, and obviously then also the glucose that is eaten. And I think that's where the main issue is as well. A lot of medical professionals say, oh, you know, it's this myth of sugar feeds cancer. And I was, okay, if you want to call it a myth, fair enough, it's an oversimplification. But so many other things happen when this blood glucose is lowered, especially over a prolonged period of time. Because what happens is healthy cells, eventually they do have to adapt, because they don't want to be starved of fuels. And healthy cells, they have this so-called metabolic flexibility to start using fats, so fatty acids and also ketones, for instance, as their main predominant fuel. And some cells in the body are actually more than happy to do so. They're happier to burn fatty acids and ketones than glucose, whereas the cancer cell struggles. It really struggles to use anything else but glucose and also glutamine, an amino acid. And that's also why we keep an eye on you know, glutamine intake, but also I wouldn't supplement it, for instance, but also on protein. And then there's so many other things that are affected by by a ketogenic diet, and especially ketone bodies themselves. So there's more and more research that suggests that the ketone bodies actually have their anti-cancer effects, or ketone bodies can make chemotherapy or also radiotherapy more effective and reduce side effects. That's something that Adrian Scheck researches a lot. And so,
could you just explain what ketone bodies are exactly?
It's basically, once your glucose is reduced over a prolonged period of time, insulin levels, they tend to fall as well, because insulin is mainly produced by the pancreas when there's a high glucose load in the blood. And obviously that's not something that is good for blood vessels or the body in general. So the body always wants to keep glucose in a certain range if possible. And insulin is one of the mechanisms to, or it's one of the only really good efficient mechanisms to reduce blood glucose fairly swiftly. But obviously if your glucose never goes up tremendously or peaks, then you need a lot less insulin. So your insulin load reduces. And if that is over a prolonged, and in some people it's 2-3 days, in other people it's a bit longer, that puts pressure on the liver then to start producing the ketones bodies then eventually. It's sort of a series of different processes that happen, and eventually the liver starts producing ketone bodies. And as opposed to fatty acids, they are water soluble, and they also have the ability to, for instance, cross the blood-brain barrier. And it's just a type of fuel that a lot of our cells can use. So there's a few exceptions. So there's, for instance, the medulla of the kidneys, there's the red blood cells, some brain cells, and also the retina that can only use glucose. But otherwise, you know, most healthy cells in our body are perfectly happy to use ketone bodies.
Mm-hmm. So a certain level of glucose is important, but only a little.
Yeah, I mean, I see people, or when I measure myself as well, when I was in really deep ketosis, and I did it for therapeutic reasons. Now it's changed a little bit, but at the time I sometimes had glucose maybe around 3 mmol/L, and I know some people are sometimes even lower. So for instance, Andrew Scarborough, who has a brain tumor and is very strict, you know, it's, and we do have evidence, especially from very, you know, pretty dated actually fasting studies done by George Cahill, who fasted people for 30, 40 days, which would be completely unethical now, that glucose can go to an incredibly low level without any of the symptoms of low blood glucose levels, like being shaky and irritable and hangry, because, you know, the energy is mainly generated by ketone bodies and other fats. So it's fascinating. Yeah, you just retrain your body to use a different fuel. It's almost like a hybrid car. The human body can't switch over. Exactly. Mm.
Okay, so you referred there to you doing this for your own therapeutic reasons. Maybe just give us a little bit of background on how you got into this whole area.
Yeah, of course. I had ocular melanoma, so a choroidal melanoma, in 2008, when I was 28, I was diagnosed with it. And it's basically a pretty large tumor sitting in the eyeball, so between the retina and the choroid, which are two layers in the eye. And I went for plaque radiotherapy in the UK because it was such a rare form of cancer that there wasn't any treatment available in Ireland at the time. And I responded really well initially. The oncologist was very pleased, but not even 20 months later, I had a really, really, really strong relapse. I mean, the tumor was bigger than before. And also I had managed to grow a tumor outside the eye, on the eyeball. It was a spread from inside the eye. So I had to go for more radiotherapy. And this time they took the more aggressive form, the proton beam therapy. And they said, we just have to, it's such an aggressively growing tumor, we have to take the strongest dose possible. That's what I did, and it obviously didn't come without side effects. I mean, even the first time around, I had side effects. I lost my peripheral vision where the plaque was stitched on, of course. And then the second time around, I really, you know, I developed radiotherapy-related retinopathy. I had edema. I had excess angiogenesis, which is a lot of blood vessels growing to potentially feed the tumor, and cataracts, you name it. So in 2012, I was really, you know, had the back to my wall, and I was told that I have to try Avastin injections, which are angiogenesis inhibitors. And if those wouldn't work, or I also had the option to have the eye removed. And that's when I took the leap and I started implementing the ketogenic diet that I had been researching for a while before. And, you know, the results were, and I always say it's the beauty of my tumor. It sounds very absurd, but you can actually look into it. You can actually see the tumor, which is obviously very unusual. You can't possibly do that with hardly any other tumor, that you can see how it behaves and how it responds to different interventions. And in my case, we did see that the edema reduced drastically, the angiogenesis calmed down.
Clarify some of the terms. You whistled through quite a few there. There was edema, first of all. Yes. If you'd just like to tell everybody what they all mean.
It's fluid. I had a lot of fluid in my eye, basically. And then, and angiogenesis is when a tumor basically grows to a certain size. It needs to attract nearby blood vessels to get fed, to get nutrients mainly. And that's one of the hallmarks of cancer, actually. So when the blood vessels start to grow towards a tumor, that's when it can get dangerous in terms of metastasizing, so spreading as well to other parts of the body. And because that was a bit of a, you know, an issue with me, I had a lot of blood vessels growing there that shouldn't be there. So that's why we were very concerned.
Mm-hmm. All right. So anyway, the ketogenic diet seems to have served you well. It's how long ago are we talking now?
It's 4 years, over 4 years ago. And we really, you know, hit the spot with it, which, you know, it's not everybody reacts in the same way. But as I said before, the retina is one of the very glucose dependent tissues of the body. And that could have, you know, something to do as well, that there was just simply not as much fuel also to feed the tumor. So who knows? it is definitely, it was away from any conventional treatment. I mean, at that stage, my last conventional treatment was almost 2 years back. So I don't think, you know, initially I was talking to my consultant, and could it be sort of the, that all of a sudden radiotherapy had a massive impact. I said, no, the half-life is not, you know, it can't possibly be that long. And that would be it's almost impossible. So,
And in terms of your situation now, do you, are you on a kind of what you call a maintenance diet of some kind?
Yeah, and that's what I'm really researching a lot at the moment. That's where I have a lot of questions as well, is, you know, how long should somebody stay on the ketogenic diet, and, you know, how extreme does it have to be? Because mainly, you know, in terms of as a therapeutic tool, there is the possibility that we might only need it for 3-4 months to really, you know, hit the tumor on the head alongside conventional treatment, and then maybe afterwards progress onto a more moderate approach. I mean, I certainly will always stay low-ish carb, and that's something where I just feel better, and it definitely suits me better. And I think the important thing as well, you have to look at it as a dynamic process. So my ketogenic approach is very different to what it was 4 years ago. I definitely tolerate more carbs. I also exercise quite a bit more, so I have to take that into account. But I do feel that the longer somebody is so-called fat adapted, the easier it is to go back and forth, and to maybe part of the time be in glucose burning, but also spend a good amount of time in the more fat burning mode, and potentially also obviously then using some ketones. But that's all questions, as you said at the beginning, questions we need answered. And I suspect it's really down to the individual. And my approach, as long as we don't have hard data, and I don't know if we're ever going to have that, because how do you exactly want to really do these rigid trials and then tamper off and go on to a more moderate approach? It would be a really hard trial to do. So my approach is to just really keep testing. I have my standard blood tests that we outline in the book as well, that I do every 12 months is the absolute longest I would leave. So every 6 months I do them. Plus on top, I do quite a bit of functional testing as well to just constantly fine tune and adapt and just keeping on the ball and not becoming complacent.
So this is a long way from being a kind of prescription that you dole out and say you do that for the next year or something. It needs to be a very responsive kind of treatment.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, that's what I find as well when I work with people. You know, things change and circumstances, the environment changes, and then we have to, I'm a firm believer that we have to change what we eat to some extent as well and go with what signals that the body sends as well.
Okay, so now I want to know a bit about what it's actually like to be on the diet. Is it a grueling regime of relentless deprivation, as some cancer diets are?
No, I don't think so at all, actually, because, you know, as we probably all know, or most people are aware of, that fat does make, you know, most foods really, really nice. I mean, who doesn't love vegetables with some nice butter or ghee or even coconut oil? And so I think the first step is for people to acknowledge, okay, instead of going for the low-fat products, I stop being scared of using fat. So I also say, you know, fat from whole foods is brilliant. So eating avocados, for instance, but also olives and olive oil is a great choice as well. So there's so many different options. And, you know, a lot of people actually, surprisingly, they start, and I mean, my main... or most of my clients are actually in the States or in Australia, and to some extent also in the UK and Ireland, but a bit less. And some people, they eat a lot more vegetables on a ketogenic diet than they have ever done before. And also, you know, things like, you know, good cuts, really good quality cuts of meat is fine. But I also ask people to start experimenting with organ meat. And it's funny, especially older people, they look at me and they're sort of, wow, am I allowed to eat this? And they have memories of, you know, nice liver pate, and they thought that wasn't a good choice. And, you know, it is about incorporating the good fats and definitely keeping up the vegetables. And it might sometimes at the beginning might mean that you have to keep obviously an eye on what vegetables and the amounts. But then, you know, eggs are a really important part for most people who tolerate them well, of course, on a ketogenic diet. I make things like chia puddings as well. You know, coconut products can be very helpful. Some people also, especially at the beginning, find it very useful to supplement a bit with MCT oils. And they can actually give a really nice... They're medium chain triglycerides. And they actually get converted or get used and converted into ketone bodies very quickly. So it's almost like a ketone supplement. And the only issue is some people don't, if you buy it off the shelf and it's not incredibly good quality, then it can cause digestive problems. So that's my word of caution, go for quality. And you know, cacao is a really great addition for people who struggle with, you know, as you said, deprivation. So there's so many nice treats, in inverted commas, that you can make with cocoa powder, for instance, or cocoa butter as well. And it's just, you know, starting to be a bit more creative. And that's what our book is about as well. Yeah, finding substitutes. Dominie always says she used to put sugar into everything. Dominie is a very, very well-respected chef, and she's been for a long time. So for her, taste is really important. And so she said she used to use sugar a lot to, you know, make recipes taste better. And now it's herbs and spices. So, and she said it works equally well. So it's just a change in mindset, and and then once that's happened, it's not that complex.
Right. Okay. So the ketogenic diet's essentially looking at cancer from a very different viewpoint to most cancer research. There's kind of less preoccupation with genetic defects and cell destruction, and it's more about the process of cancer itself. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. I guess that's why in the sort of the ketogenic world, we like to call cancer, or we consider cancer as potentially metabolic or a mitochondrial disease. So we actually, and it is quite complex, but I can send you a link if people want to learn a little bit more about that. But there are some really good experiments done by Tom Seyfried mainly that show that, you know, cancer really comes from damaged mitochondria, and it's probably a lot less to do with DNA damage in the beginning. DNA damage is more a side effect of mitochondrial damage.
Can we just quickly go into what the mitochondria is?
Yeah, so the mitochondria is basically, it's a powerhouse of our cells. So each of our cells has, you know, depending on what tissue that cell is, has a load of those different organelles. So they're the powerhouses of our cells that produce the energy of life, basically. And so, for instance, a cancer cell actually, and that's the, you know, the other important thing to research as well for people and in general, there's lots of interest in that, is a lot of cancer cells have damaged or dysfunctional or non-existent mitochondria. And that might be one of the reasons why they choose to use glycolysis, so the splitting of glucose outside the mitochondria. And so that's the notion of mitochondria, and they are really very, very powerful in generating our energy. And if something goes wrong in that whole process, so you know, there's the Krebs cycle and the electron transfer chain for anybody who wants to go really nerdy. And, you know, if something or nutrients are lacking there, or something goes wrong, then obviously, you know, that's when we start getting tired and fatigued as well, amongst other reasons, obviously. But that's where the main focus is in the ketogenic world. And, you know, anybody who considers cancer as a metabolic disease, it's really the focus is on the mitochondria, whereas the nucleus is something else. It's where most of our DNA is stored and protected, but there's actually also a little bit of mitochondrial DNA, but you know, a lot of the information of life is in the nucleus, and that's why we, you know, research has always very much focused on the DNA and, you know, our genetics, basically our genetic material. And it has always been the strong belief among, and it still is, among cancer researchers that's the problem. The problem is in the DNA. Something is going wrong. And that then leads to uncontrolled cell growth, which ultimately is cancer then, or can develop into cancer. So it's a shift in paradigm. It's a completely different way of thinking. We're looking at different things. And it's a bit of a chicken and egg situation.
Well, which is the cause and which is the symptom? Interesting. Okay, so, you know, the process and even the causes of cancer as a result of this have had kind of very little attention from the mainstream medicine and the research. So how important do you think a shift of attention away from the genes and the gene damage could be to looking at the process of cancer?
Oh, I think it has huge potential. And, you know, as we see more progress done, and there's so many really brilliant minds and researchers doing their job now into that whole shift in paradigm. And, you know, how can we come to really good conclusions that then lead to more research? I think we're really struggling with funding at the moment. And I think that's why the approach that Adrian Scheck takes, for instance, to incorporate it with conventional treatment. I mean, I'm still of the opinion you need to knock the tumor on the head. And especially if, like in my case, you know, some people ask me, would you still do radiotherapy? And I said, I probably would, because it was such a fast growing cancer or tumor that we had to knock it on the head before it did major damage. But then I think, you know, knocking on the head, stopping the growth, but then really looking at the environment. And I think that's where the focus now goes as well, because obviously the environment is very, very important. So I think it has huge potential. And also when I see how some of my clients, I just had a client there and he went through his first cycle of chemo and he really had bad side effects, very, very bad. And, you know, we made changes and he started incorporating fasting into his chemo regime. And it was amazing, the change, you know, in him and how he tolerated the treatment. So after the first round, they thought they wouldn't be able to actually follow through and really, you know, give him that particular regime that was suitable for him. And they said, we have to modify it. We have to leave longer gaps. But then, you know, making all those changes allowed him to actually get through with his regime and not having any interruptions. So I do think, you know, both will have their place. We just need so much more research now as well. And we also know there's certain certain tumours where, you know, the standard of protocol or the standard of care or the standard protocols, they're not effective in glioblastoma, for instance. I mean, there's some very outspoken oncologists in the UK who said it simply doesn't work. And, you know, we maybe prolong life by a little bit, but it's just not working. We have to look for alternatives. And I think that's why a lot of the trials at the moment, a lot of the keto trials, they focus on brain cancers and glioblastoma, but also low-grade gliomas. There are a few new ones. And the University of Alabama has one on ovarian cancer now. So we are making progress, but I think it probably will be a symbiotic thing that we will have, you know, the best of both worlds. And that's
well, this is integrative medicine, and it seems that the places that actually practice or, you know, both types of medicine in the one place, a proper integrative medicine clinic, they tend to use orthodox techniques as acute medicine and the more integrative techniques as being more for the chronic condition. So it's like, yes, exactly. There's a place for actually getting control of the situation using some of the conventional methods are excellent at just stopping the process for now, which may be damaging another organ or causing terrible side effects. So that obviously has its place. But yeah, the long-term results are often not that good because there's no other strategy for looking at the mechanism and dealing with the chronic condition.
That's exactly it. Mm. Yeah. It's like a broken leg. I wouldn't go as a first port of call. I wouldn't go to a physio or an osteopath. No. You go to the hospital first and get it treated. But then you need to have your physio, osteopathy, whatever else to be able to properly walk. And that's totally lacking in cancer care. It's just, as you say, it's just the acute. And then, you know, there's so many side effects and the toxicity of treatment. And, you know, that's where I see the big potential as well, really reducing toxicity of the treatments.
Very much so. All right. So I've actually heard it from some very esteemed sources that the whole drive to actually cure cancer is misguided. And that actually looking at it as a process, we can reasonably think of just simply controlling it. Because actually, very few people suffer major side effects of cancer until it's a very late stage. All the way through, they might not have even been aware that they had cancer until it's already a late stage. Mm. So, you know, this is a whole new way of looking at cancer as something not to be eradicated or cured, but actually just to be controlled as a process. What do you think about that?
Ah, yeah. Ah, totally. I mean, I still have my tumor as well in the eye. It's not that it's gone. It's just more a dead mass now of cells. And obviously, because of the location of it, it's really hard to get rid of all that cell debris and all the dead cells and all of that. So for me, I very much think it's all about management and, you know, not necessarily at all costs getting rid of the tumor and or being, you know, what does it even mean being cancer free? Because as we know, we all grow with normal cells all the time. It's just a matter of the immune system intervening or missing out. And I mean, in very simple terms. So I do think, you know, managing and the management of cancer is absolutely and especially looking at the environment of the tumor, is absolutely the what we have to focus on in the long term. And obviously, if a tumor causes a lot of issues and presses on other tissues or presses on important organs, that's when it becomes an issue. But in my case now, you know, it's still there. And it doesn't, at the moment, at least, touch wood, it doesn't cause me any side effects or anything. And so it's totally fine. It wouldn't occur to me to ask to open my eye again just to remove the tumor. It would cause a lot more damage than, you know, than benefits. Mm. So I totally agree with that view. And also, sometimes I think there is just so much fear attached as well. I think it's absolutely this whole psychological aspect as well. And I remember just after my diagnosis, I was one morning I was lying in my bed and I almost had a panic attack. I sort of had this vision of this thing in my eye.
Right.
And when I was a child, three of my grandparents died from cancer. So I'm very familiar with going through treatment and seeing them suffer and all of that. And I just couldn't believe it. I was there 28, and I always had, when I was a child, I tried to rationalize or imagine what I was, almost a bit, not fascinated, but sort of tried to visualize what cancer looked like. And I always saw this big crab, and all of a sudden I sort of thought, God, I have this in my eye. And, you know, it's part of my brain. It's so important. And I think the fear of cancer is huge. And once I sort of made peace with that, and for me, seeing it as well really helped. And I think we can't underestimate all the psychological, the psychological aspects and, you know, people needing to make that shift. Okay, it's still there, but it's part of me now, and that's what I've done. It's part of me. It's part of my story. It's this tumor has changed my life so tremendously, and in a very positive way as well, that it is part of me. And I think, you know, once I made peace with that, that really helped as well.
It's a very big step to move from the kind of alien invader mentality, the war metaphors, all the, you know, battle against cancer and all that, to actually saying, oh, it's part of me. It's actually, you know, and accepting it in that way is an incredibly different psychological state.
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah. Mm. And, you know, it's something that is there to show me, you know, show me something as well, to some extent. And I know it can take years to actually accept and getting your head around this. But I know in certain areas of, you know, traditional medicine or Chinese medicine, where there's a tumor, it's a part of the body that needs attention. And, you know, that's what I've sort of have started to learn. Okay, I just, you know, it's an attention seeking process, and it's a call for change.
Well, much as a wound or something is the same. You know, if you have pain, it's telling you should do something about this part.
Mm, yeah. Exactly, it's similar, it's just sometimes not as obvious. Exactly.
All right, so now I'd like to focus on the science a bit. Ketogenics have generated a more than average interest amongst the scientific community, and I say more than average in comparison to other dietary interventions. And I assume that's because of what you're speaking about earlier, the fact that it's actually got quite a long history of being used in a positive way to help people with epilepsy. Could you start by telling us a bit about the more established science, and then also tell us what's in the pipeline?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the general keto, you know, there's lots going on in diabetes at the moment as well, how the ketogenic diet can be used for type 2 diabetes, and in some cases also reversed. So we know that type 2 is, it could only be a temporary state. It doesn't mean that somebody who has been diagnosed with it, that that's it. They have it for the rest of their life. So the evidence is, it's coming out pretty strong there on the diabetic side. And then also cardiovascular disease, and in terms of, you know, there's always obviously the big question, if you eat so much fat, what happens to your cholesterol levels and all that. But science is actually pretty strong when it comes to cardiovascular disease. And again, we actually have this nice chart in our book, sort of where do we stand with, you know, different applications of the ketogenic diet. So I'd say epilepsy, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, you know, we do have pretty solid evidence that we obviously it's all a matter of really getting in the randomized controlled trials. And as you know, they are so tricky to do in nutrition. It is so hard. You can't lock people in and almost dictate them what to eat. It's a very emotional issue. And then we have, you know, emerging, all the emerging signs in obviously cancer and then also the neurological aspects. I mean, what I saw in my eye as well, my optic nerve was almost dead after treatment because it was radiated. The tumor had moved so close to the optic nerve that it had to be radiated. And we saw on the ocular CTs that there was not much going on. And the ketogenic diet has definitely helped regenerate and just making this, wow, you know, so optic nerve. And you look at, yeah.
It's actually revived it.
Yeah, when you look at the CTs, you see it, that it's looking really healthy again now.
How extraordinary.
And that has allowed, So it also is, you know, there's lots of research going on into Parkinson's, into dementia, into, you know, Alzheimer's. And obviously that's, can be incredibly challenging because it's hard enough to do it when your mental clarity or you're mentally really well, let alone then when you are very much struggling. So support is obviously critical for those people. And then we, you know, it's athletic performance. There's so much coming out at the moment. It's really exploding almost. And, you know, more and more endurance athletes, you read, oh, you know, they were running on fat basically. And, you know, then we move to, especially for athletes, there's so much research going on into ketone supplements at the moment. So I was listening just recently, the Keto Summit was on, and there was what is her name, Kieran, she's in University of Oxford. Kieran, I can't remember her second name. Yeah, she was talking about you know, how she's working with Richard Beach, and they're developing ketone esters, and she's of the opinion that it might actually make a ketogenic diet obsolete, and that we just use
take those instead. Right.
So yeah, and I mean, in for athletes. She is mainly talking about athletes. So there's this whole other world of all the ketone supplements and their usefulness, their application. So, and that's what, you know, I think is very exciting about the trials as well that are being done in the States, in Arizona. Maybe is it enough to give somebody supplements to drastically increase the effectiveness of treatment? And that's what we all have to look into, and the usefulness and application of the supplements. Mm. And, you know, where is the diet coming in? Where do we use the supplements? And it's all a big, you know, question mark at the moment. But, you know, that science is developing as well.
Mm. Can I ask about that? I mean, that's interesting. Obviously, supplements are going to increase your supply of ketones, but they don't decrease the amount of glucose. So how would
exactly
they work?
Yeah. That's actually the interesting thing when you look at the studies done by the university, Adrian Cech, University of Arizona. Glucose levels weren't really that much lower, or I think they were the same, but they supplemented with ketones and the response was much better. Mm. And that was in animal studies, and they are obviously now doing those trials in humans as well. So that's the big question. What is it all about? Is it the whole package? Is it only the ketone bodies? Mm. And then, you know, the problem could be solved by supplementing, especially people who don't want to go on a restricted diet. But I still think, you know, there's so many pathways that the ketogenic diet and also the lowering of glucose targets, especially, you know, for a cancer patient, that are so beneficial, also reducing insulin like growth factors and insulin, and then there's all those other pathways, I'm not even going there, that are affected, and epigenetic, so gene expression, epigenetics, and we don't know if the same is happening with just a simple supplement. I very much doubt it. But, you know, I'm happy to be proven wrong. Anything to make it easier, I guess.
Lastly, just want to ask you about your own plans. I mean, after the success of the Ketogenic Kitchen, I imagine you have some other plans simmering on the hob.
Yeah, always. otherwise, yeah, I could potentially get bored, and that would be dreadful. No, it's basically, yeah, the book has just been launched in the States. So that has kept us busy with podcasts. And I was on Dave Asprey's, and then Dr. Mercola is coming out soon, and a few others. And then I'm actually speaking at the Metabolic Therapeutics Conference in Florida in February. So I am going to go over to the States. And then I also have a few really exciting online projects, because I've had online courses now for a while, and where people can learn the basics, patients can learn the basics, and also practitioners. I have a masterclass. And what I found is, you know, the support is really key, and also being able to network and, you know, hold each other accountable.
Yeah,
exactly. So I am building a membership at the moment to just make it a lot easier for people to also. I have a Facebook group, but, you know, me being Swiss, I don't like the Facebook approach, where it's just it's so disorganized, it's unstructured, and it's really hard for people to find the information they're looking for. So I'm working on a membership site where, you know, people will find what they're looking for.
Okay.
And I think that'll be a really great resource. So that's the main focus at the moment, really working on that. And I've started seeing clients a bit more again, because I had to completely put that on hold, unfortunately, because of the book launch and all the turmoil it caused.
Right.
And now I'm sort of slowly but surely getting back into practicing, actually, thank goodness.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, great. So I'm delighted to say that you'll be speaking at our annual conference in London on November the 19th.
Yeah, well,
so it'll be a great opportunity for people to meet you in person. And that actually includes me, because, of course, we've only ever spoken over the phone or Skype until now. So that'll be great.
Exactly,
so I'm looking forward to that.
Very excited. Yeah.
Okay. So that's it for today, I think. Thanks so much, Patricia. It's always a pleasure talking to you. And my very best wishes to you for your own health, for all your work, and my thanks for all you've done with your passion to help people with cancer.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. And thanks so much for having me. It was lovely to chat.
Now, I hope that's given you at least a taste of just one of the avenues we'll be exploring at our conference, the subtitle of which is Cancer as a Metabolic Epigenetic Disease. Our keynote speaker is the author and researcher Travis Christofferson, who will be flying over from the States for the event. His book, Tripping Over the Truth, is groundbreaking material about cancer and cancer research, set out in a thoroughly accessible way for non-scientific readers like myself. Full details of the conference, as well as links to resources for today's show, can be found on the Yes to Life website. That's yestolife.org.uk. There's a link to the conference on the homepage, and show resources can be found by choosing Media Centre from the left-hand sidebar, and then UK Health Radio. I hope you'll be able to join me again next week for another Yes to Life show, looking into integrative medicine and its potential to help recovery from cancer. Goodbye.